everyone to Animal Voices. Gandhi said, "The greatness of a nation and its moral progress can be judged by the way its animals are treated." How are we doing, Canada? Well, this week, Brigitte Bardot, France's celebrated sex kitten, addressed a packed news conference to appeal to an end to the Canadian seal hunt. Tears streaming from her eyes, her hands covering her face as the video images of dying seals played behind her. She said she insisted she couldn't watch it. And she said, "Before I die, I want to see this massacre ended." Animal Kingdom, Animal Voices, envisions a world where the human race will finally make peace with the animal kingdom. We envision a world where human beings will no longer kill, torture, maim, or exploit fellow beings for food, entertainment, animal experimentation, or any other purpose. We recognize that animals have fundamental rights, and that these rights include that they be treated with compassion and mercy, and that they should be accorded many of the rights that human beings expect and take for granted. We know that one day these fundamental animal rights will be internationally recognized. Like all of us, animals are capable of suffering, and they are not ours to use for food, clothing, entertainment, experimentation, or any other reason. Yes, you are listening to Animal Voices, coming to you on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver, also known as Co-op Radio, your commercial-free, community-based, and community-sponsored radio station. This program is presented to you by volunteer members of Earth Save Canada, the Vancouver Humane Society, and the Animal Defense and Anti-Vivisection Society. Alan Jensen is the control room. My name is Carl. And in the studio today, we have John Pranger. Yes, hello, John.
Hi, Carl, and hi, everyone. And, Carl, you know, there are many slaughters going on in very many fields all over the planet, and vivisection is one of them, where the medical profession actually slaughters some 4 billion animals that we know of, at least, every year. And, you know, when the researchers write up their papers, and they have come to the end of the experiments, and they kill or execute their animals, they don't say they kill them. Carl, what do they say? They sacrifice them. Did you know that in our age, in our scientific age, Carl, in the 20th century, 21st century, and in a secular society, we're still perpetrating animal sacrifices?
You know, what staggers me, John, is the absolute enormity of the number of sacrifices let's call it slaughter. And that, of course, as you have so often pointed out, what advantages does this have to improving the science of the medicine of the humans?
Well, none at all. In fact, it is responsible for the enormous deterioration and destruction of our health. Let me quote a doctor to you, Dr. Wilhelm Metzger of Stuttgart, and he wrote in a German magazine, Tierrecht und Tierschutz, which means animal rights and animal defense. As a doctor and as a human being, I'm prepared to say we have perhaps a right also to demand sacrifice from an animal, particularly if we are prepared to sacrifice ourselves. But we have no right at all to commit cruelty. But animal experimentation will always be cruel. Works of erudition can never justify the frightful suffering to which the animal world is being subjected with increasing frequency by animal experimentation. And of course, in our day and age, this was written in 1932, the cruelties have become even more refined as science has advanced, and the numbers have increased, so things have not gotten better there.
Thank you, John, for your contribution. Yes, we have a great program for you today. Within a few minutes, we will interview Wendy. She's the co-founder of the World Parrot Refuge in Coombs on Vancouver Island. She educates people about not keeping parrots as pets. And if you're at your computer, have a look at www.worldparrotrefuge.org. Then at the half-hour mark, we will contact Karen Brown from the United Animal Nations in Sacramento, California, and we will discuss horse slaughter and the use of Premarin, the hormone replacement therapy often prescribed by physicians. Yes, in this week's weekly magazine called the North Shore Outlook, there is a full-page article about with a very bold headline. It's called Cage Rage, and for whom we've often had on our show here, it features Kelly Bunting, who has spent her life fighting for what she sees as unethical treatment of animals. She's holding a book written by Richard O'Barry called Behind the Dolphin Smile. Kelly Bunting has a 6-year-old son, and she teaches him about animals through real-life examples of animals, books, and the natural world. Kelly Bunting says there is so much you can do with devices like robotics and multimedia. This is how she educates her son about wild animals and relics of the past like dinosaurs. Kelly will not take her son to the Vancouver Aquarium because mammals are being kept there. The Vancouver Aquarium continues to keep live whales, sea lions, and dolphins, a policy which Kelly clearly feels is unethical. And you know, I didn't know that in Monterey Bay in California, aquarium wild animals are viewed in the ocean from a distance. Certainly a great improvement on what we have in Vancouver and in Stanley Park. So this leads me to the announcement for this coming Saturday evening, the 25th of March. That's this tomorrow for the Friday program, the 25th of March. At the there will be a premiere showing by a local Vancouver composer, and he's written a piece of music called Whales. And as all the people are going in there between 6 and 8 p.m., we're asking people who feel strongly about the whale issue and whales being kept in captivity, it would be a good opportunity to attend outside with Bob Light. And a good time to go there would be shortly before 6 o'clock or 6 o'clock Saturday evening, the 25th. And Rob Light's phone number is 604-312-5591.
Are we talking to him later on in the show?
I believe not. No, this is the announcement we make here. And so we have Wendy, the co-founder of the World Parrot Refuge in Coombs on Vancouver Island, and she educates people about not keeping parrots as pets. Well, you have a gigantic... Hello, Wendy.
Oh, hello there.
You know, I was quite amazed when I saw on your webpage, worldparrotrefuge.org, how enormous your bird sanctuary was, the refuge.
Yes, it is. Actually, we had 10,000 square feet up until 2 years ago, which had, you know, was rapid growth considering we started with them in our kitchen at the house. But then, you know, we ran out of space so rapidly. And then combined with that fear of having everything slaughtered by the government when they had this bird flu or something 2 years ago, we were right in the middle of it in Abbotsford. So as soon as that was over and done with, we were advised by Agriculture Canada that this area where we move to now has little or no commercial poultry industry, so they said this would be safe. So we came and looked and found this beautiful piece of land and decided this is where we'd build. And we thought we may as well build something that, you know, that's an adequate size to start with instead of keep hodgepodge adding pieces to it. And it's working out very well.
Now, you're open to the public, of course, but there's... could you tell us how many birds you're keeping and what kind of birds you're keeping?
Well, they're all hookbills, so they range from budgies up to the largest parrot that we have is a hyacinth macaw Andy, and everything in between that is a hookbill. We have very few budgies, cockatiels, and lovebirds, as you know. We have always, up until this year, have just focused on the larger parrots, and you know the conures up, but. It just seemed so dreadful that people just didn't know what to do with these little guys. So we said, no, we'll take them. We can't see them just being passed around either. It is just so sad that birds get passed from house to house to house all the time and, you know, kept in horrible little cages. And people just, it's the old story, let's have a bird in a cage.
And then they discover, do they discover then?
Well, from what we've, you know, we've taken in now, we've got approximately 500 parrots, probably more, but we'll stick with that nice round number. People, when they come in, they say, if I'd have only known then what I know now, I never would have done this. They're very noisy, extremely noisy. They're extremely aggressive when they get upset about things or if they get older. You know, baby birds are one thing. It's like a baby puppy or a baby kitten. Everything's cute. But as they become adult and you know, reach maturity, then they're stuck in this peculiar half world of half parrot and half human, because although they're at the very most one generation from wild caught birds, they've been raised by humans, and because they're so intelligent, of course, they copy very quickly and adapt very quickly. So they learn the way people are. Well, when they become mature and, you know, being one step away from the wild, your instinct kicks in right away. So they instinctively are at this breeding behavior level, and they bite you without any warning or expectation, or they'll be wanting to nest and they'll destroy your home, and goes on and it goes on. And a lot of them develop self-destructive behavior. You get, like in the wild, it would appear to me that macaw females will pluck some belly feathers and use them for the nesting, and then after that, they grow them back. After the nesting is over and they have a year, they grow them back, everything is wonderful. But in captivity, these birds have never had any parental consultation to say to them, you know, this is what you do. So they have this emotion. They'll pluck out these belly feathers and then they'll, you know, like, we have to pluck. But then there's no furthering of this, so there's no nesting, there's none of this stuff. So it's like, oh dear, I must pluck. And they don't know why they're doing it, because there's been no instruction. So here they are, and they progressively pluck out their entire body.
Now, give us an example of how these birds live in the wild, because I believe they live in groups.
Yes, they do. Parrots are a prey species of living being. All prey species travel in flocks or packs or herds or what have you, because, you know, there's some of them want to eat, and when you're eating and when you're drinking, you're concentrating on what you're doing. You cannot be watching everything at the same time. So other members of the flock will be watching out for the hawks or the cats, the big cats, or anything like this. And then somebody lets out the warning yell, and everybody just goes in an instant. We even see it here, because our birds have, you know, they're free fly. They have free flight space within this huge building. And if one of the birds looks outside, and if they see a hawk, they make this sound, and all the birds fly straight up into the canopy. And that's exactly what happens. Well, if you keep a bird in a cage in your house by a window, in effect, what you're doing is you've captured this animal, you've cut its wings off so that it cannot fly away. Now it's living alone instead of in a pack or a flock. Its wings are clipped off so it doesn't have the ability to fly away from any perceived danger. And it's inside a caged prison by a window where it can actually see the animal that would kill it.
Wendy, John has a question for you.
Well, you just sort of answered my question, and was also that the animal must feel very vulnerable, out of a cage, but chained to a stick or a perch, and being flightless, it has no means of escape. It must feel extremely vulnerable.
Absolutely. It's like going back to the times when they would throw the Christians in with the lions. You know, who's going to win? And it's exactly the same thing. And just people have not thought about it.
Right. And we just can't put ourselves in the parrot's shoes. We just don't do that.
No, and plus the fact that this is the thing that bothers me most of all, I think, is the fact that these birds come from all the way, you know, different countries around the equator. They're built to be outside in the sunshine. You know, their body requires direct sunlight and direct light, not sort of whatever you get through the window. And depends upon, you know, I don't know what people's beliefs are, whether you evolved or whether you were created, but these whatever it is that the belief is, these creatures are found in specific areas naturally, and their job is to recreate the forest and keep it going ecologically for their own, you know, their future and everybody else's, because it's all part of the way nature is. So now we end up with, say, for instance, a Moluccan cockatoo. It comes from a small island in the Spice Islands, and you bring that bird to Canada or to wherever, and then they breed from this bird. Now, remembering that on that island, 90% of the vegetation only grows on that island. So the digestive system of this bird now recognizes the food that it's eating and how to extract the vitamins, minerals, and proteins and everything from the food that it swallows. Now, when we have them in our homes, we show them all kinds of different things like this, different foods that we eat or we feel or particularly seem to think is good for them, and we give it to them. Now, ultimately, they recognize it with their eyes and their mind because they're so intelligent. But you cannot change the digestive system of a bird in one or two generations. It takes hundreds of generations. So by the time these birds, more often than not, by the time they get to be 15 years of age, these birds are either plucking or self-mutilating and looking just dreadful. And you can go throughout, you know, every species. African greys obviously will not be eating the same food as the Moluccan cockatoo. You know, one is from Indonesia, the other is from Africa. The food is not the same. And how can any of these old world birds be eating the same food as the new world birds from Central and South America? It's not possible. So, you know,
Fascinating.
It's just so logical to me. And then you look at these food manufacturers for them, and they come up with these wonderful pelleted diets, which look much like dog food, and probably just as palatable. The only way you can get birds to eat this stuff is to starve them until they will eat it, because there is nothing else for them. And we're told that it's wonderful. It has all these vitamins and minerals and has everything in this food. We shouldn't be feeding them seeds and anything else like that. But basically, this stuff is made from seeds and crushed, and then they mix in all the vitamins and minerals that they choose to with fillers, and then you have this dry, crunchy, hard stuff, which I've been to many jungles in my life, believe me, and I have never seen anything like this growing. And the birds will only eat it in preference to starving to death.
What is the position with the legality of importing birds? I mean, is there any way in which that can be...
It would be absolutely wonderful if it could be stopped. There's no reason why it cannot be stopped, because the United States banned importation of wild parrots. It's probably at least 10 years ago now. I'm sure that some still come, you know, in the old-fashioned way, in somebody's jacket pocket or in a suitcase and what have you. You will never stop that type of thing completely. But for the most part, it's made a huge difference. Australia will not export anything. You know, obviously, there's underhand stuff goes on there because you see it comes out of Indonesia. But basically, it has cut back a lot. We need to stop people importing because, you know, although the people that buy baby parrots that are hand-fed in this country are led to believe that this is the way to stop the capture, the illegal capture and importation of wild birds, it does nothing to do that because the breeders prefer the wild bird for the fact that it breeds more rapidly. When you capture something in the wild and you throw it into a horrible, confined situation, the body or the mind thinks, you know, we're heading for extinction here, so then they start to breed. Normally in the wild, parrots would breed once a year, and, you know, the way things are in the wild, things die, things get killed, things get picked off. So chances of them raising one baby in 2 years is about, you know, as good as it gets. In these confined situations, these horror shows where they just take the eggs away from these terrified birds and incubate them and hatch them and sell them, they're averaging 9 babies per pair per year. And if you stop and, you know, just do the numbers on this, these birds live up to 70 years, depending on the species, anything from like 50 to 70 years on the larger birds. And they're breeding them at the rate of 9 per pair. Can you imagine how many there are now? Can you imagine where they're going to go when they get old and nobody wants them? People are moving into smaller accommodations all the time, and allergies are just oh, every time you turn around, every page you open on a newspaper, every magazine, it's always about people having, you know, lung disorders and all this sort of stuff because they're allergic to this and allergic to that. Well, parrots, the old world parrots, all have a dust that enables them to keep their bodies clean. And all their feathers scrupulously clean, you know, for body temperature and flight and everything. Now imagine this in your house. It's not meant to be. It's meant to be blown away with fresh air in a jungle. I personally have developed bird keeper's lung or hypersensitivity pneumonitis from being around these birds for so many years. It's a killer disease. You cannot get rid of it. It doesn't go away. You can stop it, you know, sort of deteriorating your lungs any further if you stay away from any feathers whatsoever. But that's about as good as it gets. And we find that many people bring us birds now because they've been diagnosed with hypersensitivity pneumonitis. Now, can you imagine how the birds feel? They're trapped in a cage, breathing their own dust. It's absolutely criminal.
Yeah, now, you know, I think we're creating lots of ozone holes, as it were, everywhere.
Now, you've just answered one of the questions which I have, which I'd like to emphasize, is that the birds which we see in the pet shops, they come from being bred.
From wild-caught stock.
Like, as you said, they have 8-9 eggs. So, you know, when I spoke to you earlier, you mentioned that every day you get about 3 or 4 birds at your sanctuary here.
No, not every day. Every week we get
every
about
week.
3 or 4, yeah.
And and of course you have to accommodate them at tremendous expense because they need to have specialized food, as you so rightly mentioned. And we'd just like you to refer people to your webpage, and you know, and people going to Vancouver Island, they can come and visit your wonderful sanctuary there.
So, oh yes,
so give us the information here, and people going to Vancouver Island, make that a definite place to come and visit.
And the fabulous thing is, we don't hide the birds that aren't perfect. I'm not here like a pet store selling only perfect bird type of thing. What we do is we expose everybody, let them see what happens to birds who are kept in cages and kept in homes and fed incorrect food, never getting sunshine, never getting what their body is created for. We allow people to see this because we don't want people to buy baby birds for pets. If you've already got a pet parrot, I mean, for goodness sake, don't go running out and bringing it to us because of what we've said. No, carry on caring for your bird as long as you possibly can. If you need to know better ways for caring for your bird, please come and visit or phone me or contact me by email. I'll help you develop a better way of looking after your bird. But, you know, ultimately, birds are coming here from homes that can no longer care for them because people's lifestyles change constantly.
Thank you, Wendy. Now, tell us how to get to Coombs. Where is it?
Okay, if you come to Vancouver Island, you will get the ferry to Nanaimo, which is about halfway up the island on the east coast. And we're about a 30-minute drive at the most, a 30-minute very picturesque drive. Until you come to Coombs, it's you'll be heading towards Parksville, which is north of Nanaimo. You'll be heading that way. You'll see the signs. And you take exit 5151. And as you come down the off-ramp, it says Coombs to the left, Parksville to the right. Take the one for Coombs, and you'll go along. That's Alberni Highway. We're on Alberni Highway, and it's about 6 kilometers up Alberni Highway on the left-hand side. And we're really large. We have lots of posters. You can't miss us.
And they go to your website when they want to get details, and that is World... just give it to us here.
Okay, it's www.worldparrotrefuge.org. Now, my English accent, it probably sounds like I'm saying pirate, but I'm saying parrot, the bird, Polywanacracker.
Thank you, Wendy, and thank you for being so caring towards the parrots. You do wonderful work there.
Thank you very much.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Yes, you're listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver, your favorite animal program. And we're going to ask Alan Jensen because we have a story that Jane Goodall has to tell us. And she, of course, is so well known for the wonderful work she's done for the chimpanzees in East Africa. Over to Alan.
The 18th of March... 2003 was the day when bombs were dropped on Iraq. and it was a day I can never forget. I should have been giving a lecture in Denver, but that was the time when the great snowstorms fell over Colorado, and Denver Airport was closed. Part of it was broken under the weight of the snow. I could have been stuck anywhere. I was on a lecture tour. I could have been in a hotel where the windows didn't open in the middle of some smelly city. But I was actually on the Platte River to see the migration of the sandhill cranes. I'd gone there with Tom Mangelson, the wildlife photographer, and we were in the cabin built by his father on the bank of the Platte River. And the migration of the sandhill cranes is definitely one of the seven wonders of the world. It's completely amazing. And in particular, that 18th of March, a gift day, when I shouldn't even have been there, was so amazingly memorable. In the morning, Tom and I lit a little candle for peace, because one hoped right up to the very last moment that this invasion could be averted. When we went out, it was very cold, it was raining, so we came back into the cabin, and suddenly about 2,000 sandhill cranes with a few snow geese came right down onto the stubble of the cornfield just outside the cabin window, closer than Tom's ever seen them before. And for about 2 hours they were feeding there on the corn grains left over from the harvest, and first one group and then another would perform that amazing dance. They're like feathered ballerinas, and they pick up tufts of grass or clods of earth and throw them in the air and spread those great beautiful wings, and finally they flew away. But as I was watching them, it seemed to me, are they bringing a message? Because I actually think that sometimes animals bring messages if we would just open our hearts and listen to them. And it seemed to me that these cranes, which are symbols of peace in so many countries around the world, perhaps the message that they brought was there is going to be a long, dark tunnel ahead, but there is light at the end of the tunnel, and peace will come in the end.
Yes, welcome back to Animal Voices, and Alan Jensen, thank you for that nice music. Our web page is www.animalvoices.org. Many of our programs are listed on our web page, so if you'd like to re-listen to any of what you've heard in the last years or so, just go to www.animalvoices.org. Well, there's a wonderful organization in Sacramento, California, and their mission, the mission of the United Animal Nations, is to protect animals in danger or in need and to focus global attention on their plight. So their webpage is www.uan.org. And on the line today we have Karen Brown. Hello, Karen Brown.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, you know, it's one of the very disturbing factors is that this horse slaughter is happening both in Canada and the United States. And that's why we're really very interested in what you're doing. So maybe you can give us a little outline.
About what we're doing with well, basically, we have several programs that bring animals out of crisis and into care, and our programs extend throughout the United States and also into Canada. We've been campaigning against Premarin since the mid-1990s, and we've been doing that by encouraging women to switch to a humane alternative. There's many alternatives out there. And we've also been encouraging the adoptions of horses that are used in or born as a result of the PMU industry. And that's what we do with our anti-Premarin campaign.
So give us maybe an outline of why Premarin is not only not advisable for humans, but also bad for horses.
Sure. There's many reasons why Premarin is bad for horses, and I'll go over those first. First of all, it might help for, you know, the listeners who may not be familiar with Premarin to define what that is. Premarin stands for pregnant mare urine. It's not a very disguised name for what it is. And I don't know who first thought of using pregnant mare urine as a drug, but it's been around since the early 1940s. It's used for menopause symptom relief. And so it's been around for a real long time. It's been an extremely popular drug, and that's why we've been advocating against it, because of why it's so bad for horses. First of all, the industry really encourages excessive breeding, and we all know that horse slaughter is a really big issue and something that we're very much anti-slaughter for many reasons, but the PMU industry is only adding more unwanted horses to the horse population. They use very large horses. They like to use draft breeds because large horses pee more. And they're also breeding based on taste because they want to breed the horses that sell well in the meat market. But not only that, there's the way the horses are cared for is one of our objections. Ranchers have a recommended code of practice, but compliance with that is voluntary. And then even if you go by that recommended code of practice, we don't find that it's adequate. The minimum stall width is only 5 feet, even for the largest horses. You can imagine Clydesdale in a stall only 5 feet wide, and she's in there pregnant all winter long when it's negative 20 degrees outside, and she's in the stall throughout her pregnancy during the winter. And they do go into fields, and they birth in the fields. But not only she's in the stall, she's strapped to a urine collection cup so that her urine can be harvested and then turned into this drug that's then given to women. Since there's so many horses involved on each farm, these farms are usually family-run operations, and you can't expect a family of, you know, say, five people to take care of 200, 300, 400 mares, pregnant mares, with the kind of attention that you would like them to be taken care of. So they typically have horrible, untrimmed, overgrown hooves. They don't have very much human interaction, very little training. They don't get much exercise while they're in the stalls, so lots of issues just with the way they're kept. And then, of course, the foals are born every single year. They're weaned early, usually at 2, 3, 4 months of age, and they're sent to auctions. And as many as 70% of the foals in the past have ended up in feedlots. So.
Now, what they slaughter the foals, I presume.
And the mares when they stop being, maybe if they don't get pregnant. So.
Then, okay. So what's happening to the meat? You said that they're using particular types of horses because of the taste of the meat.
Yeah.
So who's buying the meat?
Horse meat is considered a delicacy in several countries, not so much in the United States and Canada. We don't view our horses as food. But they get slaughtered here, so they can be shipped to Japan and France and Belgium. And these aren't unhealthy old horses. These are young horses in the prime of their lives. This slaughter doesn't have anything to do with disposing of old horses. That's one of the most common myths.
Right. Now, the alternative to Premarin, pregnant mare's urine, is synthetic, which is just as good. And, of course, we'd like to talk about the discredited drug, Premarin, which was so widely described. Maybe you can just...
Sure, I can talk about both of that. First of all, there are many alternatives to Premarin that are either synthetic or plant-based. And part of the problem is that those companies haven't been given the attention that Premarin has been given, so their drugs haven't had so much of a chance to be pushed. And we're hoping that as more women make the choice to avoid Premarin and Prempro and the other drugs that are made from pregnant mare's urine, that those drugs will become pushed more to the forefront and more research will be done on them so that more doctors will prescribe them as opposed to these other drugs. What happened with Premarin was that more than 9 million women in the United States were taking that drug, and I believe it was just as popular in Canada. Wyeth, the company that makes it, was peaking in 2001 with more than $2 billion in sales. And then a series of really big studies were released by the Women's Health Initiative starting in 2001 to 2003, and those studies showed that that Premarin and Prempro were linked to increased risk for breast cancer, blood clots, strokes, heart disease. For a period of time, it was in the news all the time, that every day it seemed like a new horrible thing would happen to you when you take this drug. So a lot of women dropped it. They just dropped their prescriptions like a hot potato. But even then, even at the end, in 2003, Premarin, you know, had dropped from number one prescription to number 27. So it was still a very common drug. And even though so many women are avoiding it now, Wyeth is fighting back. They don't want to lose that income. So they are promoting their low-dose versions. And the low-dose versions weren't involved in those studies in 2001 to 2003, so they haven't been proven unsafe. Not yet, anyway.
Well, the definition of quackery is to practice medicine with an unproven remedy. So I guess we're talking about quacks here.
Well, a lot of women do say that these drugs do alleviate their symptoms. We're not arguing with that point. Mm-hmm. But their safety is can definitely be called into question.
So I presume that with the $2 billion in sales previously, that with the fewer prescriptions being made now, there will be fewer funds available to lobby the physicians who continue to prescribe that, and which is quite sad that so many of them are get all the information from the drug companies.
That's definitely an issue.
Are you offering information through the Mayo Clinic resources?
We have resources on our website. We also have a message board. You can find our message board through our website at www.uan.org, where women who are interested in avoiding taking Premarin and Prempro can talk with each other and share their own ideas with each other. We found that really linking women together who are all committed to avoiding these drugs will be a great way to spread the word about alternatives and share ideas with how to talk to your doctor. Wyeth is really pushing these low-dose versions of these drugs. There's been advertisements that are on the TV and in magazines. They've taken on Cheryl Ladd, the former Charlie's Angel, as their spokeswoman. She even has her own website that they've created for her, all about her talking about menopause and ideas for talking with your doctor about how Premarin and Prempro and their low-dose versions can help. So they are not going down easy on this, and they do expect their sales of the low-dose versions to go up this year. So we're fighting back by continuing to spread the word that these drugs are still made from horse urine. There's still abuse involved, even though there's far fewer horses involved now than there used to be. There's still a lot of abuse involved, and especially with horse slaughter being set at the forefront of so many animal advocates' minds. This industry just needs to not be there for horse slaughter, too. It'll really help with that. So,
because of the cost of keeping a horse, and not everybody is able to do that, the whole idea of rescuing horses from these slaughterhouses is at best just symbolical. How are you people approaching that?
That is a very good point, that there's, a ton of horses going out, and but the reality is that there are a lot of people who have horses, and that they might have room for an extra horse, and we found that a lot of the problem is just getting the people, the ranchers who maybe have these extra horses or whose contracts have been cut, connected with potential adopters. And that's why we created our website, PMURescue.org. We've had more than 50 different ranchers and rescue organizations advertise their PMU horses available for adoption, and close to 1,400 pregnant mares have found horse homes through that website. So we have been able to make a difference. It's a drop in the bucket. But one thing to keep in mind is that every time someone adopts a PMU horse, that horse is now an ambassador for the rest of the PMU horse situation and for horse slaughter in general. So it's another way of spreading the word. Every time that horse goes out and competes in horse events or meets someone, that person is going to now learn about PMU, and maybe they'll avoid Premarin That's the way that the circle can come full circle.
Karen Brown, she's from the organization United Animal Nations. It's www.uan.org. And thank you, Karen, for making people aware of what they're doing when they take this drug and how it affects the animals, and for helping to diminish animal cruelty in the world. And maybe you'd just like to conclude by summarizing what you've said.
Well, I definitely appreciate having me on the program and spreading the word. We have a website, PMERescue.org, where people can go and find horses available for adoption, and they can also go to our website at uan.org to talk with other women about ways to avoid Premarin and choose humane alternatives.
Thank you, Karen. Okay, and over. And now you're listening to Animal Voices on Co-op Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver. And over to Ellen and a little bit of music.
Back with Animal Voices, 102.7 FM here in Vancouver. A disaster warning from the United Nations as investigation reveals half of the planet's 500 biggest rivers are seriously depleted or polluted. The world's great rivers are drying up at an alarming rate, with devastating consequences for humanity, animals, and the future of the planet. The Independent on Sunday, a British newspaper, on 12th of March, 2006, revealed that more than half the world's 500 mightiest rivers have been seriously depleted. Some have been reduced to a trickle in what the United Nations warns this week is a disaster in the making. From the Nile to China's Yellow River, some of the world's great water systems are now under such pressure that they often fail to deposit their water in the ocean, are interrupted in the course of the sea with grave consequences for the planet. Adding to the disaster, all of the 20 longer rivers are being disrupted by big dams. One-fifth of all freshwater fish species either face extinction or are already extinct. The Nile and Pakistan's Indus rivers are greatly reduced by the time they reach the sea. Some, such as the Colorado and China's Yellow River, now rarely reach the ocean at all. Others, such as the Jordan and the Rio Grande on the U.S.-Mexico border, are dry for much of their length. Even in Britain, a quarter of the country's 160 chalk rivers and streams, such as the Kennet in Wiltshire, the Derwent in Kent, and the Wylye in Wiltshire, are running out of water because too much is being abstracted for homes, industry, and agriculture. On the week of 12th March, an influential UN report officially warned the world's government of an alarming deterioration in the planet's rivers, lakes, and other freshwater systems. Klaus Töpfer, the executive director of the United Nations Environment Program, told the IOS yesterday that the state of the world's river is a disaster in the making. The UN's Triennial World Water Development Report, compiled for an international conference in Mexico City, which opened on Thursday, warned that we have hugely changed the natural order of rivers worldwide, mainly through giant dams and global warming. Some 45,000 big dams now block the world's rivers, trapping 15% of all the water that used to flow from the land to the sea. Reservoirs now cover almost 1% of land surface. The UN report said that demand for them will continue to increase, but recommends that they should be barred from the world's remaining undammed free-flowing rivers. The United States has dismantled 465 dams in recent years, mainly for environmental reasons. But last week, in an abrupt U-turn, it signaled that it was about to embark on its biggest dam-building campaign in decades, when the Washington State Legislature passed a bill to allow the federal government to build a series of dams on the Columbia, the West's largest river. Global warming is endangering even the rivers that have largely escaped damming. The relatively untamed Amazon was hit by its most serious drought on record last autumn, and salmon are dying in Alaska's Yukon River, the world's longest undammed watercourse, because its waters are getting too hot. On Tuesday of that week, an International Day of Action saw demonstrations across the globe to draw attention to the river's plight. And that's from The Truth is Out There, www.loveandfearlessness.com. or www.communitypipe.org.
Thank you, John. And we're going to go over to Dr. Jane Goodall and that wonderful CD with Dana Lyons. And, recently they... last year we had the Animal Voices Film Festival. Dana Lyons was here, and he presented this show here with... Dana Lyons singing songs and Dr. Jane Goodall telling stories from her own experiences. The CD is called Circle the World. And over to Alan Jensen.
And Sprout. One day I was following Satan through the forest, 23 years old, a young male in his prime. He got his name when he was just a kid. He actually stole a manuscript that my mother was writing, and we had to bribe him with a banana to get the chewed remains back again. But that was long ago. And now he's traveling alone, and suddenly he hears ahead of him the sounds of an excited group of chimpanzees feeding, clearly on something delicious. Imagine this with 20 chimpanzees, all making the same excited cries. Satan's hair bristles with excitement, and he hastens along the trail and soon comes to a big tree. There's a lot of fruit up there and many chimpanzees feeding. And he swings up the trunk and he aims for a large bunch of ripe red fruit. There's a younger male feeding there already, but that's okay because Satan is dominant to him. So he approaches and he makes a arm threat gesture. The young male screams and backs away, and Satan begins to feed. But what Satan didn't realize is that young male's older brother is feeding higher up in the tree. And hearing his kid brother scream, he comes swinging down, and now the two brothers start attacking Satan, and Satan screams. To my amazement, a very ancient female who was peacefully feeding way up in the canopy starts swinging down, and she hurls her frail self onto these three battling males, each of whom weighs at least twice as much as she. And with her puny little fist, she begins hitting at the two brothers, who I think are so surprised that they mildly threaten her, and Satan gets away. That was Satan's ancient mother, Sprout, probably at least 50 years old, hair thin, teeth worn down to the gums, but still running to the defense of her great big bully son.
Thank you, Alan. And that was John Reichman. He's stringing the guitar there in a tune in his CD called Up in the Woods. Well, as we all know, that despite mounting pressure from around the world to stop the annual harp seal slaughter, it's expected to begin later this month. The Canadian government has refused to call it off. Canada's Department of Fisheries and Oceans recently announced the quota for the 2006 slaughter, which will allow fishermen to kill 335,000 seals this year. So that's 10,000 seals more than was killed last year, or $15,000. While time is running out for the seals, concerned individuals, organizations, coalitions, and celebrities from all over the globe have amplified their efforts to put pressure on the Canadian government in hopes that they will step in and save the seals. As we know, mentioned in the previous program, Paul and Heather McCartney recently came to the Gulf of St. Lawrence, during which they visited the young seals destined for slaughter. And they called the world's attention to this impending atrocity. And they appealed to the world community and the Canadian government for compassion. They sang, "All we are saying is give seals a chance," to television news cameras who were documenting their trip. Following up on the McCartney landmark peace mission, activists held a global day of action against the seal hunt last week in countries around the world. And it's really giving Canada a bad name. I think we're being known as being people who don't care, really care on a government level for the animals which we've been endowed with by nature. And they've been protests in San Francisco, in Los Angeles, all over the world. And enthusiastic activists gathered to hold up signs and banners and chant and pass out information to passers-by about the seal slaughter and its inherent cruelty. And it's inherent cruelty because we know that mothers are watching their baby harp seals being slaughtered. Well, I've got John making eyes at me here, and over to John. We only have a few minutes left.
Well, there's nativeradio.com's position on the harp seal slaughter. They're on commercial free community radio, CFUV 101.9 FM or 104.3 cable. And www.cfuv.uvic.ca. So they're at the University of Victoria. And nativeradio.com has always supported indigenous culture and causes. The Inuit have the sovereign right to subsistence hunt seals for seals for food and commercial needs. The Inuit are not hunting baby harp seals, but rather adult ring seals. They also do not use brutal killing tactics and are not decimating a species of animals. Our fight is not with the Inuit, but rather the Canadian government and the commercial slaughter of baby harp seals. The Canadian government likes to tell the world that this slaughter is 98% humane. The facts and documented evidence show that this to be an outright lie. What is 98% humane about clubbing to death 12-day-old baby harp seals with a large ice pick called a hack-a-pick, many requiring second strokes? What is 98% humane about skinning alive these defenseless creatures? What is 98% humane about killing baby harp seals so someone can show off their expensive seal pelts? There's a difference in an indigenous culture's right to hunt for food and economic survival and the non-indigenous Newfoundlander's massive slaughter of defenseless animals for profit and vanity. NativeRadio.com does not condone the killing of any creatures, but we do understand the Inuit's right to do so. We believe that baby harp seals have as much right, if not more, to be on this planet than we do. We will continue to do what we can to make the world aware of this slaughter and to do what we can to stop it. Thank you very much, Patrick Doyle, who is the CEO of NativeRadio.com.
Yes, and of course, with the celebrities that were in Vancouver and Canada to protest the seal slaughter was Brigitte Bardot, as we mentioned earlier. And she said, "Before I die, I want to see this massacre ended," she said very tearfully. And she has been outspoken and been ridiculed for it. Well, we speak out on Animal Voices. We speak out because we envision a world where human beings will no longer kill, maim, torture, and exploit fellow beings for food, entertainment, animal experimentation, or any other purpose. And our webpage where we post many of our programs is www.animalvoices.org. www.animalvoices.org. And we'll finish off the program by thanking you for listening, and have a wonderful quote from Mahatma Gandhi, the pacifist, who said, "The greatness of a nation and its moral progress can be judged by the way its animals are treated." We'll be back next week.